Ladies and gentlemen, I am thrilled to say that this gentleman is coming to the Bridgewater Hall in Manchester on the 27th of this month, which is so exciting. It is Frank Sinatra Jr. Hello, Frank.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I am so, so delighted.
The honour is mine.
I've seen an awful lot of interviews you've done. You come over as a very knowledgeable, very intelligent man with a gift. And you have a gift, whether you like it or not. You do have a gift. I've tried to think of questions that you've never been asked, and I can't, because you've been in the business so long and you've done so much and you have so much history. You're the most difficult man to interview.
I'm sorry that you feel that way. I always thought I was very straightforward.
You are. That's why I'm just very excited. Who was your biggest influence? Was it your mum or dad?
Influence in what respect?
In your life?
Well, in my life, there was no one singular person. There have been many influences. Many people who lived centuries before I was born. Speaking to you in Liverpool, I can only tell you, if we want to subdivide big influences, one of the biggest is somebody who came from Britain.
Really?
Who I've been studying for an entire life. And that was Mr. Churchill.
Wow! How interesting!
People have said to me, let me show you how I apply his philosophy to my own experience, Mr. Price. People have said to me that they found that Frank Sinatra, who was part of my life personally, was oftentimes very, very difficult and had enemies. Now, can we bring into this story what I learned from Mr. Churchill, just as an example? One day, just when the Blitz came in 1940, and everybody was making themselves comfortable in the underground every night when Hitler sent his planes over, I believe it was the Archbishop of Canterbury, the head of the church in England, was talking with the First Minister of the British Empire. And he said, Mr. Churchill, since you stand on the side of justice and civilization, why do you have so many enemies? He was referring to the Parliament. And Churchill made a statement which I never forgot, which is applied to Sinatra and everyone else I've ever known. When the Archbishop said, why do you have so many enemies? Mr. Churchill's response was, Your Grace, the man who has no enemies has no character.
Interesting.
In other words, if you stand for something, you're going to make enemies. There will be an opposing stance somewhere. And this is the kind of thing that has influenced me. What that grand old man had to say applies to my father in his personal life.
Why do you think your father had enemies?
Because he had character.
Right.
Because he stood for something. If you take a stand about something, someone is going to object.
Sorry, he was a very outspoken man, your father, wasn't he? He didn't take any garbage.
He was when it became necessary to be spoken out or otherwise. This is the way of things. We had a man like Mr. Churchill in the United States. We had a man whose name was Harry S. Truman. And President Truman, and I tell my friends all the time, I wish we had him right now. He used to say the same thing about different viewpoints making enemies. He used to say, politically, for example, if my opponents will stop telling all those lies about me, I will stop telling the truth about them.
That's fantastic.
I've been influenced by many people, yeah. Mr. Price. Many people have influenced me, either before I was born or since.
Yeah. I'm sitting in a tower 450 foot in the air. I look over to my right, and there is the Liverpool Empire, where your father played. And people still talk about it, all those years ago.
All right. No, I have been in Liverpool. I have been all over England.
Yeah.
My first trip to what they now call the United Kingdom was in 1964, and I arrived at Liverpool when the Beatles went to New York. And in those days, I don't know if they still exist across the British Isles, we used to have Odeon theaters.
They're still here. They're still here.
I played all the Odeon theaters, and that was my introduction to what you're seeing out the window from your tower.
Oh, amazing. Do you have other influences in music? I know you were a pianist and you love what you do now, but do you have other influences in music?
Well, I was trained in the classics. When I was a little boy, my mother, like all mothers, wanted her little boy to have certain advantages, like a little girl would be sent to ballet school. Well, I was never graceful enough to go to ballet school, but my mother decided she wanted me to take piano lessons. And so from the age of five, I was made to learn how to play the piano, which I did very poorly, by the way. But I did use it to write certain melodic lines and harmonic lines. And through the years, I use that to create certain music, certain songs and the like.
Tell me, as a little boy, were you spoiled?
In many ways, it happened, and in many ways, it was prevented from happening.
Mm-hmm.
My mother and my father both came from very, very humble origins, and they did not want me to forget that and to take a look at life as though life did not have its humble origins, if you follow me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is something which I am deeply in their debt for.
With your father being such a legend, has it ever been a problem for you? Have you ever rebelled and thought, I'm sick of being Frank Sinatra's son?
Oh, of course. Of course, years ago when I was starting out, people expected me to be of the same talent that a seasoned veteran like Frank Sinatra was.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was not there. You have to begin somewhere. You have to learn a craft. You have to fashion and shape your endeavor. And it takes time.
I see the other day the man who created or reinvented Vegas has just died. The man who owned MGM, the man who...
Mr. Kerkorian.
Yeah. Did you know him at all?
I knew Mr. Kerkorian very, very briefly, and this goes back 50 years ago when he was just starting out. He had a wonderful idea. If you want me to dwell on this, I will tell you.
Please
about
do.
How
please do.
He became so successful. Kirk Kerkorian came from humble beginnings, Armenian, and he had an idea that business was very, very healthy and very, very growing in the field of aviation. And as you know, we are surrounded in our lives by airlines, scheduled air traffic carriers. But then there are also non-scheduled airlines. And whereas if a company or someone, some movement needs to charter an aircraft somewhere, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Mr. Kerkorian hit upon something which was totally revolutionary. This in 1963. He was the first man to build a financial program and use jet airliners as chartered aircraft. He started a little tiny company called TIA, Trans International Airlines. He went to Douglas Aviation in California, and he was able to buy three DC-8-63 full jet airliners, the same kind that were used by the airlines across the world. And he put these planes into service in a non-scheduled chartered business, and it made him millions, millions and millions. With the money he made from selling Trans International Airlines, he then built what was called the International Hotel at Las Vegas, Nevada, in 1969. That then he sold, and it became, which it is today, the Las Vegas Hilton. Mm-hmm. The money he got from that sale, he bought controlling interest in another big, this time a real airline, Western Airlines, which served the southwestern United States, even more than that, from the Pacific Coast up to Washington and then all the way to the Great Lakes area, Minnesota, and the like. This company was then absorbed by another big airline, Delta Airlines, which of course comes into England now. And the money he got from that, he built the original MGM Hotel.
Wow.
Which today is Bally's Hotel at Las Vegas. And from the sale of that, then he built the current MGM Grand, the one you were mentioning. So in accordance with what they teach at any school in London, money begat money.
Yep.
And he was able to turn this into a complete empire.
You know,
and it was wonderful. He was a very humble man.
Yeah, I'm so glad you told me that, because I believe he was humble. I believe he never went to the premieres when he owned MGM. I believe he would go to the local cinema and go in a pickup truck, and he was very, very laid back.
He was not affected by his success or his affluence.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very generous man. He gave a great deal of money to charities, and he built several hospitals. And he helped organizations. He never forgot his humble roots. And Mr. Kerkorian was always very nice to me. And I did not know him well, but I admired him for his business acumen and for the fact that with the power of his wits, he was able to build an empire.
I'm talking to Frank Sinatra Jr., who is at the Bridgewater Hall in Manchester on the 27th. And I just think it's going to be amazing, absolutely amazing. Whereabouts do you live in the States? Where are you based?
I live in Southern California, Mr. Price.
Oh. Do you do Vegas regularly?
No, sir, I do not. I wish I could tell you I do, but Las Vegas today primarily is a show, rather a town, that puts on shows as one-nighters.
Right.
Very, very seldom now does Las Vegas have anything that runs for any length of time, unless it is what we call a book show, which they can put in and usually, you know, produce, they can buy for the right price.
You come across as an incredibly intelligent, interesting man, which makes me think, what are your interests outside music?
My interests outside music, I'm very interested in the world we live in at this moment. You and I, who are breathing the same air, just a hemisphere away from each other, are nonetheless, we are seeing things which are really quite remarkable. If you think about everything that's going on around us, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to keep in touch with life, and there's so much life. And its pace has picked up so severely. The pace of living is so severely since we entered into this digital computer age.
Yeah. Especially with music.
And, well, I'm very, very disenchanted with what has happened in the music industry. As far as I'm concerned, there is no music anymore of any new nature.
Yeah.
We still have some people in the world we still have Leslie Bricus, we still have Rupert Holmes, we still have Paul Williams, we still have Michel Legrand in Paris. We still have people who take an interest in creating music, but they are the absolute minority. And it is so unfortunate, because when you think of this wonderful flow of music that we once had, I have had a big, big time arguing with people. They say, oh, well, you practice, and here is that euphemism, the great American songbook. And I say to them, that is a racist comment. Does the great American songbook recognize Ray Noble, Leslie Bricus, Andrew Lloyd Webber from England? Does the great American songbook include Michel Legrand in Paris? Does the great American songbook include Antonio Carlos Jobim from Brazil? I mean, to say the great American songbook is racist in my estimation. It should be called the great international songbook. We have got contributing people from across the world.
Frank, would your dad be cross at the way the music industry has gone if he was alive?
When he was alive, already the decay, the degeneration was taking place. Personally, I cannot give you an exact quotation, but personally, from my perspective, I can tell you every time I believe a certain trend in music comes around that has hit an all-time low, somebody comes up with something even lower. Mm-hmm. Now, today, you have what they call rap music.
Yep.
Rap, that's the biggest oxymoron I've ever heard. There is no music in rap music. There is some kind of rhythmic pulse, which is usually made by a machine. And then there's somebody with a high school camp intelligence stating very mundane, tasteless high school camp poetry. And this passes now as music. And I pity the generation of children that are growing up and listening to this, that this is what they believe should be qualified as music.
Fascinating, man. Tell me, your mum's now 97. How is she, and do you spend much time with her?
She is 98.
Oh, 98, wow.
She is now 98 years old, and she is just wonderful, and a lot of times, at this point in her life, she does not wish to have visitors, per se, in person, but we speak on the telephone every day. And she is just remarkable, Mr. Price, in one respect, and that is that she has reached this age with no longevity in her family.
Wow.
Both her parents were dead before they were 65. Mm. And I tell her often she has proven that it can be done.
She was your dad's one true love, wasn't she?
That I could not tell you.
Oh, right.
There are many different opinions I've heard through the decades about who was his, as you put it, true love. Mm-hmm. This I cannot, I can't really answer. Mm.
Do you still enjoy singing? It's a stupid question because you wouldn't be doing it, but do you actually enjoy it still?
I enjoy it on occasion when I'm doing it right. If I'm not doing it right, then it becomes a burden.
So you're your own self-critic?
I believe most professional people are.
Does your son Michael sing?
No, thank God. Not smart like me. No, my son Mike is, he is a true academic. My son Mike lives in Japan.
Oh.
He speaks, reads, and writes fluent Japanese. He is certificated by the imperial government as a master of the Japanese language, and he teaches English in a college in Japan to Japanese students where they learn English as a second language.
You must be proud.
I'm proud of the fact that he is an academic. He's a professor. He's very bright. He is studying statecraft as well. And I remember a moment ago we were talking about what's going on in the world. Well, that area of the world now, the deeper we get into the 21st century, that part of the world, which is called in print the Pacific Rim, is becoming so vital to everything in our lives. It's going to affect all of us.
12th of December. He's going to be 100 years old, bless your dad.
Can you imagine that?
What are you going to do for it? Anything?
That night, I will be doing our new show, which I will tell you about, in Southern California. We will be doing a concert that night. And I say our new show in the sense that since his death in 1998... we have been doing a program that the people in my office named Sinatra Sings Sinatra. And I had anticipated at the time of his death in 1998 that we would do this show perhaps 18 months or 2 years as a celebratory show honoring his life. But when we did it for those first 2 years, the audience out there that still loves his music, they still want that music. Mm-hmm. And we have been doing it ever since. Only now that it is 100 years since his birth, for the first time, the show has gone audio-visual. And the first example in England will be right there outside your window in Manchester. And that show that comes up at the end of this month is audiovisual.
Wow. If you hadn't have been Frank Sinatra's son, where do you think you would be today? Do you ever think about that?
No. No, you know, we are what we are. We can't go back and say what if, really, in that way. I mean, I suppose we could, just as a point of imagination. Mm-hmm. But isn't it rather pointless?
You certainly make everything sound so perfect in the respect that you're a no-nonsense man. You know exactly what you want to say. It comes over loud and clear. I love it. I love your directness. I love it.
Well, I appreciate your being complimentary to me, Mr. Price, but no, nothing is perfect. If we find perfection, we're in heaven. This world of ours is imperfect, and what keeps us, I think, going as a species is to try to make it more perfect.
Well, to be perfect then, did you like your performance in The Sopranos, or could you have done that better then?
That was just what we call a cameo.
Yeah, but it was perfect to me.
Well, I love that television series.
Yeah, yeah.
I absolutely adored that show, but the fact was, when it was in production, it became a phenomenon of television. And the people on the staff on Sopranos told me that like once a month, Jack Nicholson's manager was calling them. They wanted to put Nicholson on the show. Mm-hmm. They had received overtures from Al Pacino's people, from Robert De Niro's people. And the man who created Sopranos, a man named David Chase, who I had worked with when I was on staff at Universal Pictures in the 1970s, when David Chase was a line producer, David Chase said he was not going to make Sopranos a cavalcade of stars. He didn't just want to put the big famous actors and actresses on the show, because then the show would lose its realism. He preferred to staff Sopranos before the camera with stage actors and actresses who had a lot of experience in the theater, but who the television audience would regard as literally people off the street, which is what Sopranos was about. So when they called me in 1999 And they said, we want you to appear on Sopranos. I remember I was sitting in an office when this request came in, and I damn near fell off the chair I was sitting on, because word had gotten around that Sopranos just didn't hire anybody. They did not hire the biggest stars in the world. What do they want with Frank Sinatra Jr.? So they sent us a shooting script, and I figured, now I see what's going on. I went and filmed with those people for 5 days, and it was one of the best film experiences I've ever had. It was like going on vacation. I loved being on that program.
Frank, have you had a happy life?
Sometimes. Sometimes.
Had some bad experiences, haven't you?
Don't you think that everybody belongs, that we all have bad experiences?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We see that the children of the big Hollywood stars fall into very bad lifestyles sometimes. How did you manage to keep away from that?
I saw, frankly, you know, I think the best teacher for all of us, Mr. Price, is example. And I saw what happened to some of those very people you just mentioned when they did fall into bad lifestyles. I don't think it's worth it. I have never been, now, please don't misunderstand me. I am no saint by any means, but one of the things I never got involved in is narcotics. I never used narcotics, nor did I have any interest in such a thing. And I never was a degenerative gambler or anything of that nature. But there are, as you say, bad lifestyles, and it probably comes from the fact that the children of the big stars that you're speaking of, they have the time, they have the leisure, and they have the affluence to make such things as that happen. Now, in the Midwest of the United States here, the Midwestern people, primarily agricultural, they have a saying, a Sunday school saying, the devil findeth work for idle hands. And I think those people you're talking of, the children of the celebrities, I think they have idle hands.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
I know
a
exactly.
cheap metaphor,
yeah.
I grant you, but
no,
I think that's
works.
Pretty good.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah.
Tell me, did anybody get close to your dad? Did you get close to your dad, or did he keep a distance?
Oh, no, he had a lot of people who were close to him. Regrettably, I was never one of them. I was never around him because when I was a boy growing up, I had school. He was a young, very popular performer. And there were occasions, year after year, he was making 4 movies per year. Plus his concertizing, plus his recordings, plus his television and the like. And he just was rarely around because he recognized, and appropriately, show business is so damn fickle.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that there's a saying about that. When the phone stops ringing, the silence is deafening. And this is what happened. He said, we have to take it while we can get it. Then, when I became an adult, I went out into my career. He was doing his thing. I was doing my thing. The only time I ever really was close to him was during that period between 1988 and when he retired from singing in 1995. I became his musical director. I traveled with him, and I would like to believe that I contributed to his efforts in his final years.
Could he take criticism or not?
Of course he could. This was not a lofty personage to that point. It was very down to earth, which most people could never conceive of.
Mm. Frank, what's your very last memory of your dad alive?
I saw him in a... That's a very intuitive question, by the way.
Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. I said intuitive, not offensive.
Oh, right.
Let me tell you what it is, and it's bittersweet. When his health really began to fail, and he was gaining on 83 at the time, he was, by and large, sedentary. A lot of times he sat in a wheelchair. And I saw him looking out the window on a nice sunny California afternoon into his garden, and I could see on his face that he was left alone with his memories. And this was my last memory of him. Hopefully it was a peaceful state of mind. It appeared, the look on his face was that it was a peaceful state of mind.
When you're on stage singing, is he with you?
Oh, yes. When I'm doing this show, oh, he's with me.
This is the most difficult thing to ask, or a difficult question to answer, or you might be able to answer straight away. One song, is the one song that is everything to you, whoever's song
no.
it belongs to? No?
No. No. He had so many states of mind which were communicated to the audience in different songs he did. Some of the songs were happy songs. Some of them, as we call them, feel-good songs. Other songs were dark, and some were just plain sad and broken-hearted, for which he became famous. And he had all of these colors in the emotional spectrum on his palette.
Can you sum up his gift? Because I've seen so many people in the press try to describe his talent. Can you sum him up as a son?
Well, you have just asked me to give you the epilogue in our program.
Right. Wow.
And
so they've got.
Well, what happens is, in the 80 to 90 minutes of our show, we present glimpses of different periods in his life. This musically and visually. With still image and mm-hmm. moving image.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the show, I speak to the audience over very, very soft underscore, and I say, do we dare risk an epilogue? Do we dare risk a conclusion? And the epilogue conclusion that I give to them is the answer to that question. What was it about him that made that work so beautifully?
Frank Sinatra Jr., I cannot thank you enough for giving me 33 minutes of your time. You're a very busy man. You're coming to the Bridgewater Hall on the 27th in Manchester. I really can't say thank you enough. I don't know how to say thank you. It's been a joy. I've interviewed many people in my life, but it's been a joy.
If you are present that night, Mr. Price, make yourself known. If you're going to be there that night, make yourself known to me so we can shake hands.
I will certainly try that. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. All right. So long.